Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
We need this kind of leadership. God knows I'm not providing it. Hello and welcome to Dungeon Deep Dive. Each week, we bring a little bit of deep dive to your fantasy world. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge that the land that we're recording on is a stolen land. It's the land of the Turrbal and Yuggera people of Meanjin, otherwise known as Brisbane. We want to acknowledge that sovereignty was never ceded and that these lands were always places of teaching and learning and storytelling. And we'd like to pay respects to any elders past, present, and emerging. And if you'd like to be part of the conversation, if you'd like to have a voice on the show, we'd love to have you.
You can reach out to us on any of our socials at Dungeon Deep Dive or email us at deepdivetnc@gmail.com. Had to think about that one. That goes for anyone.
I mean, absolutely. If you want to get in contact about anything we've said on the show, if you've got corrections, if you've got suggestions, if you've got requests, or if you want to be on the show, please just get in contact. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah. Look, I'll even read your draft gotcha journalist articles about me. I'm really just that kind of desperate to talk to people at this point.
To have emails.
You may be able to tell from the quality of the recording. We'll see how this goes when I edit it together this time. But this is the second episode that we have recorded remotely for reasons that should... if you look at the release date of this episode, I'm sure you get why.
Exactly. But if you do not understand why we are recording at home, we envy you.
Ugh. God, yeah. A flash forward to a simpler time. So, forgive us for any audio issues. Just wanted to get that out of the way up top. And with that, today we are talking about games.
Oh my God, sorry. I noticed that we got an episode ages ago.
Oh yeah?
I've somehow missed it in all the Twitter stuff. An email from Cassidy Winter.
Oh!
Hi, Cassidy Winter. Hey, Deep Divers, just emailing in response to the hair episode because you asked for one. Lots of interesting stuff. While you did mention that hairstyle and length have been extremely gendered over the centuries, I noticed that none of you mentioned the European medieval punishment for hair cutting for women. While I'm certainly no expert, I'm fairly sure it was intended as a humiliation thing. In such a society, with such a heavily enforced gender binary, it must have been an extremely severe thing to be forced to have a feature that didn't, however temporarily, match with it. Off the top of my head, a recent example is Game of Thrones, where Cersei Lannister's hair is forcefully cut in preparation for the Walk of Shame. Anyway, keep up the great work, y'all. From Cassidy. Oh, thank you, Cassidy. You have breathed so much life into this recording.
That was
already.
That was incredible. Thank you.
Shout out. We love you, Cassidy. Thank you so much. We're sorry we didn't put that out until now. As you can tell, we get a lot of emails from Twitter and none from real people. So thank you so very much. I'll respond to that as soon as this episode is done recording. But a bit of a shout out there.
Yeah. And I mean, that is a good point. I don't know why we didn't touch on that, actually. That seems like totally up our alley. That's a really good point. But I mean... I'm no expert on the practice either, but I do know that it was specifically like a humiliation thing. I think it was also kind of in part, if I recall correctly, not so much about the gendered elements at least on paper, and was more about like stripping someone of their personhood. The kind of reduction, like I was kind of talking about with the idea of like using, like taking hair as a political act. I believe that that's more what the earlier practice was, more a predecessor to that. But obviously, like, gendered elements would have absolutely been a play. I don't know the specific history of it being used against women. So that's definitely something to look into.
We should look if we can do some revisits of some episodes and look into stuff like that.
I can't remember what he says. I can't remember what he says about it, but I'm pretty sure Victor Hugo has a chapter about like hair-based humiliation in Les Mis, when what's her name cuts her hair off to sell. Like, he has a whole thing about like that very particular humiliation. I can't remember it. I will search it up at some point.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So it's clearly
Victor Hugo was very into writing in the specifics of whatever was going on. There's probably some very, very relevant work there.
Yeah. That's, I mean, man loved to write. Got to give him credit for that.
Absolutely.
Thanks to Les Mis, I know a lot about 18th century nunneries.
Ooh.
Mm. Ooh.
That was not the point there of the, well, that wasn't the point of the book. He just really liked them.
He just really liked them. Apparently sewers as well, and prostitutes.
He was a man of many tastes.
A man of great and varied taste.
Yeah, he contains multitudes, Tully.
Anyway, thank you so much, Cassidy, for emailing in. It's absolutely lovely to hear from one of you. And please, if you have anything you'd like to add, be it small or enormous, we'll take anything from one-line emails to essays.
I'm not trimming any
of this. So shout out to Cassidy, our number one fan.
I'm not trimming any of this down, and we're going to sound so desperate, Tully. It's going to be absolutely ridiculous, and I want you to know that I'm not going to save us. I'm not going to save us from this.
I'm just going to come in and say
I mean, I'm happy with that.
I'm just going to come in and say I am desperate for attention. I have straight up asked, like, publicly on my Twitter account, please listen to this and make memes of it. I can't carry this by myself. There has to be one other person on Twitter making hyper specific Dungeon Deep Dive memes.
Well, you just need a Dungeon Deep Dive subreddit, I think, is the solution.
I think that's the solution.
Maybe we can get our own like image board going. Oh no. Right now? Really?
Right
in
now.
This moment?
I just wanted to see if you can hear it on the mic.
Yes.
Yeah, I can hear it. Okay, so Tully is lightly dyeing his hair in the middle of this recording, which is a fun development.
Well, if you can hear it, then I won't. But I was just going to see if I can get away with it.
You could not.
You could mute your mic.
Okay, cool. That's fine.
You could mute your mic.
Yeah, but then I can't respond. Anyway, we should jump on in and have Grace start off.
Me? Have we said what topic we're doing? We're doing games.
No, we haven't.
We're doing games. I can't remember.
Okay, we're doing games.
I've been so starved of human interaction, I've forgotten how conversations go. We're doing games. I'm specifically today looking at children's games, just because not sure if you've noticed, but can any of you guys ever remember having somebody sit down and teach you how to play half of the games that you played as a kid? Like, did someone sit you down one day and was like, here are the rules to Tiggy?
No. In fact, it was pretty controversial when at my school, everyone had so many variations of their rules to handball that the school had to implement official rules. And there was like a riot.
Mm-hmm. We had a similar deal we were a very big Tiggy school, and there were all sorts of like variations where eventually my grade got a version of Tiggy that you played on the playground that also doubled as like the floor is lava band because some kid broke their hip.
Oh.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Dear God.
Yeah. It was good fun.
Oh, yeah. Clearly always a good idea to let children make up whatever rules they want to whatever games they like. That seems like the takeaway from this.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, come to think of it, I've never, ever learned the rules to hopscotch.
Yeah, you just, like, do it. You just pick it up.
Yeah, you just do it.
I actually, hopscotch, weirdly, is the one I kind of do remember. I remember being in, like, grade one and another one of... And it wasn't, like, an official thing. It was just, like, a grade three kid came over and showed me how to do it because I didn't understand what to do in the double square parts. And so I remember being taught the rules.
That's cute.
But it was just, like, from someone else who happened to have been told them as a kid. Like, there was never an ant. It wasn't, like... I like read the hopscotch rule book.
Wait, you never read the hopscotch rule book?
Well, I have since, obviously.
Yeah, but a lot of these games, like, they don't have static, decided upon rules. These are rules that are like super regional that you learn as a kid. Generally before you even can remember that you were taught them from like siblings or friends you meet at a park or like older friends from like your parents. It's always just like stuff that you pick up before you're able to remember picking it up. And a lot of that comes down to like children's culture in terms of like kids go crazy about stuff that adults just like don't understand and don't know where they picked it up from because they all hang out and they have their own little thing going on.
And I imagine that something like Tiki or whatever as well, it would be pretty easy to spread because I mean you go up to someone and you hit them a little bit with your hand and then you sprint in the other direction, then like you now know how to play Tiki. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. And then you just keep doing that until everyone's gotten it.
Yeah.
They're also super easily spread because kids just kind of go wherever their parents go. So if you have a parent that moves house or moves country, or you have a parent that just like doesn't want to take you to the park that day, so they take you, you just like play outside your house. Every time you go out, you're going to a new place and meeting new people, which means you're picking up new stuff from everyone you meet or teaching them. So a lot of these children's games go back centuries, and it's literally just like each new generation of kids starts to teach it to whoever they're talking to at the time.
That's interesting. So it's just like as opposed, I guess, to adults. So if you had such a like formative, such a like a specific friend group that you had such like, that you'd formed such specific games and rituals and stuff with, you'd just stay with them.
Because they're like, a lot of the time these children's games are aimed at quite a young demographic, like 12 or younger, and a lot of them don't have like friend groups. They just have like a bunch of people that they know that they all hang out with.
That's true. Until I was about 14, 15, my friends were just like the kids that lived in my street.
Yeah. I mean, I, even as somebody who went to the same school from prep to 12, I don't really remember having had like a friend group per se until I was probably about 12 or 13.
Yeah, I had like three friends in primary school.
Yeah, I think the closest thing I had to a friend group was just the handful of people's houses my mum would let me go over to because she liked their parents. So there's also like some children's games that have sort of either come from adults or adults have decided, hey, actually, we like this too and we want to do this. So the game Bly Men's Bluff apparently was just like super popular in the courts of Tudor England, and Henry VIII just went crazy for it.
Remind me?
Bly Men's Bluff.
Bly Men's Bluff is essentially like Blind Tiggy, where you blindfold someone and then they have to like chase after you. Usually it's in quite a small room and the idea is like you have to like get out of their way or squish up against a wall. But if they wander around, they can hear your footsteps and they can hear you. So they're supposed to come and get you.
It's Land Marco Polo.
It's Murder in the Dark.
It's Murder in the Dark, but like less fun.
Well, it's Murder in the
Dark. Because the person who's it can't see you.
Well, I mean, that's kind of the point of Murder in the Dark, right? Is that they can't see you.
I guess
you're just giving them the handicap that they were supposed to have by the dark.
Yeah, but apparently, Lip,
I mean,
if you were a very upper-class Tudor England guy, you could hang out with Henry VIII and play Blind Man's Bluff.
And if you were in Townsville Youth Theatre in 2012, you could have played it with me.
I know what I would prefer.
Tudor England.
Oh, absolutely, every time.
Off with her head, am I right, boys? So, I mean, obviously the classic capture the flag, very clearly like a children's version of like a war game. The idea is, you know, you win your battle by taking your the other team's flag as you would in quite a lot of old battles. So yeah, it was basically kids looking at what their parents are doing and they were like, I can do that too. But mum won't let me have a sword, so I guess I'll just like tag you and you have to go back.
Yeah. A lot of games come about because parents don't let kids have swords.
It's weird. You would have thought at some point in history parents would have been chill.
Well, that's how rugby was invented. It was because the government wouldn't let students have guns. They were like, we're not doing war anymore, but it would be nice if you kept fighting each other just in case. So here, take this. And they just threw a rugby ball down and they were like, go nuts, gang.
Go get them, boys.
Keep that war in spirit.
So marbles have been found in pharaoh's tombs and in Aztec ruins. And unlike a lot of children's games, there's no like universal way to play marbles. It's just kind of like whatever country you're in, they've got a different set of rules and a different idea of how playing marbles is supposed to go. But didn't become super popular and widespread until the early 20th century, when like mass production of glass meant that kids could buy like whole bags of marbles for really cheap. So originally it was kind of like a humble brag on the schoolyard. You were like, ooh, yes, daddy bought me marbles. But then they started making glass in factories and any shitty little kid could come up and be like, look what I bought with my pocket money.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you could go so far as to say, though, that there are so many ways of playing marbles that it is actually, there is no longer a way to play marbles anymore. Because that's marbles in my experience, is everyone shows up with such different rules that they are unwilling to reconcile because everyone is 8 years old. And everyone says, you know what? Never mind. We're not playing marbles. And then you never, ever play marbles ever in your life. And you just have 100 marbles in your wardrobe for no reason.
Yeah, that's consistent with my experiences.
Yeah, cool.
My experience playing marbles was, I think I got like a set bought for me at some markets once. And anyone else who had marbles just kind of traded them for the ones they liked best. Like I'd turn up to school with my marbles and I wouldn't play a game. I'd just be like, hey, I'll swap you this purple one for that pink one because I like it better.
Yeah, that was my marbles experience.
Mm-hmm. Hopscotch, classic, evolved from Roman war agility training.
Really?
Yeah, so they would have sort of obstacle courses set out either in ropes or drawn onto the ground that you had to go through in full armor.
I suppose it kind of is reminiscent, the modern day drill is reminiscent of, it's the tire challenge where they have the tires you got to run through.
That would have been like the modern equivalent of what they were doing back then. And originally you had to run through it with your whole armor on and your sword and everything. And I guess either kids looked at that happening and thought, hey, I want to play pretend. Or their dads came home and were like, this is a fun thing that I did. Let me show you.
Yeah, I can see that taking off.
Plus, if you're like, if you're in the ancient world and like your social status is decided by the fact that like you're like a soldier's family and like your children will be soldiers and your parents were soldiers and you're like living that legacy, then it does make sense to get your kids all
training
like, train in agility, especially at a very young age, because I mean child labor laws were not a thing, so you could be
yeah just get conscripted at the age of 12.
Yeah, why not? I'm sure it's happened.
Oh, probably.
I think this has come up recently thanks to sort of the resurgence of the plague. But ring around a rosy or it's got a billion names, but that as a game has a lot of variations. It's usually the same little rhyming poem, and you sit in a circle, and basically the idea was that you sing your little song, and then when they say, like, we all fall down, you were supposed to, like, sit down the ground, and the last person to sit down the ground had to go into the middle of the circle and, like, decide who sat down last, so they were, like, the judge. Although when I played it in school, it was like you just had to copy the person standing in the middle. So you'd sing the song and then they'd like do a pose, and the last person to copy their pose had to get in the middle of the circle.
That's so weird, because that's like that there with the like mimicking element is like every child's game in the world combined into one thing. It's like Simon Says meets every circle game ever meets fucking...
It's basically a drama class warm-up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, but I thought it was interesting because I didn't realize that was one of those games that had variations of how to play it. And I was reading this, so I was like, hold up. That's not what I did.
I never even learned it as a game. I always was taught it as like...
I just knew it as a song.
Nursery rhymey dancey thing, yeah.
So there's like there's a handful of other games. So it seems like Sleeping Lions seems to be quite a universal classic, which I have a feeling stems from the fact that many parents ask their children to lie down and be quiet for a little bit.
Yeah, I imagine that one didn't come from the kids.
Hey, we're going to play the quiet game.
I did love it as a kid, though. Fucking any excuse to just lie down.
Yeah.
Wow, have you been like this forever?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I loved Sleeping Lions. I won Sleeping Lions every time. Every single time. I lost it once when I was 3 in preschool and never since.
I have a history with Sleeping Lions because I did know it as a game. And in grade 1, I think, we had to play it. And it was, like, before lunchtime. And, like, whoever won the game got to go out for lunch early or something. But the teachers were going around. They'd, like, lift up your arm and see how, like, loose and, like, floppy you were.
That's fucked up. That's
and I was
cheating.
Like, that's not the rules. You're not allowed to do that.
That's interference.
Yes. I'm still a little salty about it because I was like, this isn't how it's done. You're cheating. And then you've got like skipping games for which there's a billion songs, only some of which I remember.
Like skipping rope?
Yeah. Skipping rope. So either just like the single rope or like a double dutch. It seems like the double dutch one comes specifically from rope weavers who would like weave the rope and their assistants would have to jump through the rope in order to like give them stuff. And I guess kids just looked at that and they were like, hey, that's cool.
And they were right.
Yeah, that's very cool.
They were right. I never learned how to do double dutch, and I was always so jealous of the girls that could.
Okay, when we get out, we're learning double dutch.
Yeah, okay.
Absolutely. Yes. So, Bloody Knuckles.
Oh, that's the...
If you remember that game.
That one?
Mm-hmm. You put your two fists together, and you basically have to, like, hit each other on the top of the fist as hard as possible until either somebody gives up or they, like, flinch and pull back.
See?
Yeah.
Interestingly, and this, I guess, leads, it's just like a fun foreshadowing for my topic. I actually only ever learnt that as chicken, and it wasn't until much later in my life that I realized that chicken meant a bigger thing than just that game of hitting your hands together. I really thought that, like, that and the version where you slap each other's hand, I really thought that was, like, that was the whole thing. That's all that
chicken is. Because chicken I knew... closer to jousting. It was like unskilled jousting.
Well,
it was run as hard as you can at each other and then be the one that doesn't flinch. And I always flinched because I was friends with crazy people who would just barrel through me.
Sorry, that's the version you played at school?
In year 5, it got banned.
Oh my god, yeah, I bet.
It got banned shortly before Bull Rush got banned.
Borish got banned at my school too.
I'm not surprised.
We called it Red Rover. Man.
Yeah, we had Red Rover and Bulrush, pretty similar.
Yeah.
I think us kids called it Red Rover, but the teachers called it Bulrush. So I think that might be a generational thing.
I think we had the opposite.
I think mine was the same as Grace's. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the last one I have written down here is the knife game, which I remember not from being a little kid. Which I remember not from being a little kid, but from being like an edgy teenager where all the guys in class would do it with their like sharpened rulers.
Oh, God, yeah.
Apparently that's a universal children's game, either with like a knife, I guess, if you've got cool parents, or just like sticks and pencils and stuff. And the idea was just like, how many times can you do it? Can you flex to your friends?
Mm. Yeah, we had pencils were used a lot. No serious injuries in my grade, I don't think.
We used scissors. I never did it, but everyone that did it around me used scissors. It was pretty fucked up.
Mm.
But that's a sailor's game originally, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Yep, it came from sailors. It was sort of like a betting game where you'd like bet against someone. It was also sort of like, I mean, the same way we use it to be like cool and edgy and show off. They were like, I'm a big, tough sailor. Look at my big knife and look at how good I am.
Mm. Well, yeah, because there was a period where to be a sailor, you would just show up at a port and kind of show off until you got like a captain's attention and went on the ship. Like, you were just one of a random assortment of sailors at port that day. So, like,
that really does provide so much context for any sort of depiction of sailors you have historically, because it's all so very showy, and that suddenly all makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a big part of why, other than just for like personal commemoration, it's also probably a big part. I think it's a big part of why sailors get like the specific tattoos for different accomplishments and stuff. It's like a resume.
Yeah.
And showing off at port and gambling and being like loud and strong and drinking and playing like a knife game and stuff. All you're doing is just flexing for captains.
To be fair, also, I'd get cool tattoos and show off and be like kind of a big head about it if I was doing one of the most physically demanding and important jobs in like a historical city.
Oh, you'd be a fool not to.
If I was a ripped sailor, I'd be like, yeah. Yeah, look at my big knife and look at my big tats. Like, yeah, but that's all I brought. It was sort of like looking at how universal these games were and the fact that Lachlan and I grew up on two different sides of a state, and in fact across two states, and yet every single one of these games we've both played. Hmm. Tully, you're from Brisbane too, right?
I'm from Sunshine Coast, so I'm a little bit north of you.
Yeah, but mm-hmm. I mean, I learned all of these games in Sydney, and I know them mm-hmm. by, it sounds like, pretty much the same rules as you guys as well, more or less.
Yeah, more or less.
Yep. And like also a lot of these games came from you know, England, from Aztecs, from Romans, and like these are all games that we have played now in like a very modern era that they have been playing forever, despite the fact that like children don't really have like history books they whip out on the playground.
Exactly.
Well, great, thanks for that, Grace. So now I suppose I just want to take a step back for a moment, kind of zoom out a little, and I want to talk about games in a broader sense, specifically through the lens of game theory. And I think that game theory can be useful for a few different things in terms of D&D specifically, and so that's what I'm gonna break from my norm a little bit and actually talk about Dungeons and Dragons. kind of. So
there's always a kind of.
Look, I... So game theory is essentially, it's a way to model conflicts. It's a way to look empirically at situations where multiple different actors, all with their own interests, are forced into a situation, a game, where they have limited options of what they can do, or at the very least, limited outcomes that they could achieve. And so game theory looks at these interactions. Things like, and I mean, it can be anything. It can be anything from a game of chess to, any, I mean, it's anything. It's any game, really.
Mm.
I was going to give more examples, but there's too many.
There's actually a really interesting debate. Sorry to derail just a little bit, but there's actually really interesting debate over what actually qualifies as a game, because there's a number of different definitions that are sort of generally accepted. Let me just find it here. Okay, cool. So the first philosopher to actually define the word game was a person by the name of Ludwig Wittgenstein. Now, Wittgenstein argued that elements of games needed play, they needed rules, and they needed competition, but they failed to adequately define what a game is. So Wittgenstein concluded that people apply the term game to a range of disparate human activities that bear to one another only what one might call family resemblances. This was not the final sort of definition, though. A lot of people had a crack at it. Roger Kailua, I think is how you pronounce it. Kailua.
Sure.
Yeah, it's a French name, but it's not. I'm not familiar with how exactly to pronounce it. But it's in his book Games and Men, and defined a game as an activity that needed fun. So it needed to be lighthearted character. It needed to be. It is circumscribed in time and place. I am not exactly sure what that means there, but.
I think it just means that it needs to be over a specific period of time in a specific location.
Okay, yeah. So it's got to be fun. It's got to be a defined like time period. The outcome has to be uncertain. It can't be productive. It has to be governed by rules, and it has to be fictitious. So it's accompanied by an awareness that this is a different reality.
Mm.
That's the definition that took over there. But yeah, there's a bunch of other sort of definitions that people have had a go at. It looks like, though, it's very contentious, even to this day.
Mm, yeah. Because realistically, it really just depends on the context. I think a lot of the disagreement about it comes more from a disagreement between... Not a disagreement. A clash between disciplines more than an actual clash in understanding. Because, yeah, in some contexts, games do have to be trivial. They would be called what some computer scientists would call hedonic information systems. So essentially a program that only exists for self-pleasure, something that's hedonistic.
It's interesting that bring up different fields as well, because of the three definitions that feature the most prominently just on the Wikipedia page, I'm not that much of a researcher. one is a philosopher, one's a sociologist, and one's a game designer. So they all have very different fields.
Yeah, so I'm looking at games more in the, I suppose more in the philosophical context, but by way of maths. Which will hopefully become even remotely scrutable by the end of this. So
cool, I've got my whiteboard, I'm ready to go.
For our purposes, a game is just any interaction between multiple players. It doesn't matter what those players are or what they're doing or why they're doing it, just any interaction between multiple players where each player chooses from a set of possible actions. And that has to mean that essentially enables each player to create a strategy, like a set of rules to guide them through the game. So in game theory, in the context of game theory, it's used in a few games. Games are looked at in a few different ways. Sometimes economists are using them to try and explain or predict like markets and stuff. It's not a perfect system, obviously, but it can be useful to look at like game logic when you're dealing with things like that. I think the more interesting use of it though is the like kind of psychological, sociological view, which sees game theory as just part of how you explain rationality in general. It's essentially the idea that we are all using game logic when we come to a situation. We don't always follow game logic, but it's part of our rational decision-making every time if it's something we're capable of. So it's less a way of predicting outcomes and more a way of understanding a big part of like the rational decision-making process. So there are a couple of things that you need to know when you're dealing with this sort of thing. You need to first work out if each of the players in your game know what the other person has done, if it's a sequential game. So that would be like a game like chess, where you see, oh, white moved this pawn here, and so I'm going to do this in response. And
yeah,
you work that way. That way you can map it out as like a tree, essentially. Otherwise, you're dealing with a simultaneous game, which is a game where it doesn't necessarily mean that you're making your moves at the same time. It just means that you don't know what the other person's done until you've both done your thing.
Mm.
So it's the difference between... Here's the best example of it. Take a game of chicken, for instance. Imagine, because chicken is probably best defined as a type of game more than anything else. It's just a game where two forces are going to collide. Their intentions are completely opposed to each other. And if neither of them give in, then it's essentially mutually assured destruction. It's the worst possible outcome for all of them. So that would be what they would both rank as their lowest. So we'll put that as, so say that's zero. Then your other options, the other possible outcomes are you don't give in and go straight through if they move out of your way. So they give up and you get everything you want. So that would be your best option. So that'd be like number, so that'd be three. So your next best option, other than obviously just getting through and getting what you want, is if both of you stop. Then neither of you get it, but you don't have them beating you. And then obviously the other option, not your worst option, but your next two, is if they succeed and you move out of their way. Because that way you don't die in the car crash. But obviously it's not what you want. Sorry, Tully is drawing and I'm eager to see what this looks like.
Tully has a whiteboard that he's been using.
Yeah, I'm trying to visualize what's going on by putting it all in a whiteboard. So I'm going to take some photos. They're not going to be particularly interesting, but they're going to go up on the Instagram, I think, because they're vaguely squarish.
If you want a visual reference, then there'll be one up on the socials. But the important thing to remember is two cars coming together. If they hit each other, they both die. If one of them moves, the other one gets through. And if both of them stop, then both of them are safe. Now, if you're playing a normal game of chicken, you don't know what the other person's going to do until it's far too late. So your best option is always going to be to move out of the way, because that way you avoid dying. You avoid the worst possible outcome. But this changes if you have more options available to you. Then if you're dealing with a situation where you can still see what the other person's doing, and they have the option to say rip out their steering wheel so they can't move out of the way, then you are forced to move out of their way.
Sorry to interrupt the flow. Quick question: which is the worst result in this scenario for, let's say, player one? Is it for both of you to crash into each other, or is it for player two to win?
The worst outcome would be to both crash into each other, because then you'd die.
Excellent.
Yeah. That's why chicken's a good way to look at it, because the worst option is not an option. You can't let that happen. So no rational person is going to keep going. But then you add in the option to commit and to broadcast that you're committing. And all of a sudden, the other person's options change and you force their hand. They have to move out of the way because you've shown that you can't. And I mean, there are examples of that in history. There was a French military leader by the name of Cortes who was invading some Aztec territory. And he had a pretty small force, so they landed at shore. And he realized that his soldiers could all see this paradox. He feared that they would notice because, I mean, if you're a soldier, it's just a game of chicken. You either know that if you stay, you could be killed. And, I mean, if your military force is strong, then do they really need you? But if it's weak, then...
So that they could not leave.
And if you leave, then... I mean, you avoid dying. So that's why people shoot defectors. And what Cortes did was they landed in the Aztecs' territory and he burned their ships down. But he burned... So they couldn't go back. But he burned them down in view of the Aztecs. So they saw that they'd committed and the rationality then changes. The whole thing changes for everyone because the soldiers are forced to stay and to fight the strongest they can because it's that or certain death.
Yeah, so there was no possibility of them running away, so they were going to fight as hard as they could to the end.
The Aztecs, on the other hand... Exactly. And the Aztecs, on the other hand, saw a military commander so confident in his victory for a reason that they couldn't ascertain that he destroyed their only means of leaving right in front of them. And so the Aztecs fled. There was no battle.
This is not something that I'm entirely familiar with, but I am familiar with that Cortes was a very, very clever strategist.
The description I was reading of it earlier described it as the easiest military victory in history. He burned down some ships and they won.
Jeez.
The enemy fled. Because if you don't know why they're committing, you just have to leave. And so that's kind of how you can model these things into real life scenarios.
And
I thought it would be interesting as a DM to take these situations, take something like a game of chicken or the prisoner's dilemma is a good one. That's the game where two prisoners have to either confess to the police and get a light sentence and get like a medium sentence or not confess. And if the other person does, then they'll go to jail forever. And if the other person doesn't, then they'll get the lightest possible sentence. So everyone can agree to be like, oh, we won't talk to the cops and get the light sentence. But then if you do that, you know you're leaving open the door for them to fuck you over. And so you have to confess every single time because you get an okay outcome or you get completely free because the police punish the other person.
I think that'd be really fun to do with, you know how, like, every party gets attached to that one NPC, you know? Mm. I think it'd be really fun to do that with that one favorite NPC where it's like, okay, so you don't want to risk your life for this person that you did just meet 3 days ago and you think he's funny because he's got a funny name. Are you going to do it?
Hell, I mean, you could do it with the whole party. Put the party in different rooms, talk to them individually, see how much the characters trust each other. Have them all agree.
You guys are very bold discussing this the day before I plan for our next session.
Oh, I know.
No, it's it's fine. I don't really... Our party doesn't really know each other. We're just here for a laugh.
Mm-hmm.
So.
I mean, you're not wrong.
But I also think that it's useful from a player's perspective because I feel like so often we don't... The thing that stumps me as a player and stumps players that I've DM'd is not having a framework to go through options, to like not having anybody.
I mean, this is this is already as a player helping me contextualize what I'm going to do in your campaign when the shit that just hit the fan hits the fan.
Yeah, exactly. It's a good way, because if you know more or less what the other person can do, and you know more or less what you can do, and you know more or less what the possible outcomes are, you can start planning things out. And you can look at it and you can be like, will I see what they're doing first? Okay, that way I can plan for every option. If I don't, then I just have to pick the one that's most likely to be good. I would flag for anyone, any DMs out there, because it's obviously easier if you're a player, because you're just using it as a way to like work out what your good options are. But if you're a DM and you're trying to predict what players are going to do, then I would just flag a couple of different things. Because as any astute listener may have noticed, this doesn't necessarily entirely model to what people are actually going to do. It is really just about what people will think about when they're doing it. So there are a couple of like paradoxes when you bring like human emotions into it. One of them is like the regret aversion theory, which essentially says that you're not going to pick the option necessarily that's going to get you your most preferable outcome or that's most likely to get you preferable outcomes. You're going to go for the option that is going to minimize anticipated regret. So you can see that in situations where, like, for instance, so say you've got two briefcases. One of them has definitely $1 million in it. The other one has an 89% chance of $1 million, a 10% chance of $5 million, and a 1% chance that it'll have nothing. The like utility theory, the like traditional idea of looking at game theory, would predict that you'd pick the one that that could have $5 million in it, because I mean, if there's an essentially, they expect you to disregard any similarities between the two. Like, both have minimum 89% chance of $1 million. So you just look at the last 11%. And one of them is an 11% chance of $1 million, and one of them's a 10% chance of $5 million, and a 1% chance of nothing. So you go with the better one.
Yeah.
However, people don't. They go with the million. They take the guaranteed every time. Because what they're actually avoiding is the small risk that they will regret not taking the first option.
It's interesting that you bring this up. I was actually thinking about the Monty Hall problem, which is, you know, that the classic thought experiment. Well, maybe not classic, but the thought experiment. You've got three doors. Behind one of them is a prize. You pick one, and the host of this magical game show that you're on, you're in a game show now, says, okay, now I'm going to reveal what's behind one of the other doors. Behind one of the other doors, there's nothing. And then offers you the choice to switch to the final door. Now, theoretically, when you chose at the beginning, you had a 1/3 chance of any of those being the prize. But now that the other door has been opened, for either of the doors that are there, the one you selected or the new one. So now for the new door, there's actually a 50% chance that that's got the prize. But people will almost always stick with their original door. There must be a psychological trick where, again, they couldn't bear the regret of moving away from the prize door.
Well, I mean, and I think the game theorist's take on that was to...
One eternity later...
At this point, we proceeded to get carried away with the Monty Hall problem for about 45 minutes. It was an incredibly in-depth conversation in which we came to some conclusions about the assumptions we'd made about the game. Point is, though, it was boring to you and irrelevant to you, so we've cut that. And on with the show.
Hey,
it was boring to me.
Don't rope me into this. I went on Twitter. I had no horse in this race.
What the fuck was I even talking about? So I think the final thing that's probably important to keep in mind is this thing called the Ellsberg paradox, which is essentially that if you're given the chance to take a risk that you understand versus a risk that you don't, you're going to take the risk that you know even if there's a chance that the other one's less. So imagine that you are standing in front of an urn, and in the urn is 90 multicolored balls. 30 of those balls are red. 60 of them, the other 60, are either black or yellow. You have no idea.
And you don't know the proportion.
You don't know the proportion. You have no way to work it out. If you were given the option to get... If you were told... Yeah, if you're given the option between a $100 prize if you pick a red ball or a $100 prize if you pick a black ball, people will almost always pick the red ball, even though there's only a 30% chance, because you don't know what the chance of the black ball is.
Yeah, it could be one or it could be 69.
Yeah, so if you're looking at it from like the idea of min-maxing, then there is a good argument to be made for the black ball. But if you're looking at it from like the way people actually do it, every single time people are going to pick the thing that they understand the risk of. On the other hand, if you're told you can get $100, take a ball out. If it's red or yellow, you'll get $100. If you're told you can pick that or the same deal, but it's a black or yellow ball, then again, because you don't know the proportion of yellow, but you do know the proportion of black and yellow, you'll pick black and yellow every time, even though you don't know what either of the balls are.
So
the idea is just people are always going to pick something that they can understand, something they can conceptualize. If they know what...
Yeah, that makes sense.
And the benefits involved are, then they're going to go with that. It's less intimidating as an option. So if you ever find that you're like planning a quest or something that involves like a series of like different approaches or whatever, and you make it clear that one of those approaches is very dangerous and don't explain the rest of them, then you're running a good chance of your party picking that really dangerous option, just because they know what they're getting in for. So it's just like, I don't know, it's just an interesting way to kind of like trick your party into doing things.
Yeah, trying to get your party to do what you want them to do, I imagine, isn't easy, considering I have been a party, and every time I finish a session, I'm like, we didn't do anything. We've done nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's...
On a side note, from a player perspective, I love playing dumb shit characters now, because it means you don't get caught with the analysis paralysis. You can comfortably, in character, say, I'm making a decision. It's probably wrong.
It's so freeing.
It's so freeing. I would highly recommend it. Play a character with no intelligence and very little wisdom.
So I guess the takeaways from this episode are plan things out and pretend that they're a simple game. Or do whatever the fuck you want. And there's kind of your options.
I like to play my characters and make decisions as if I'm writing in fan fiction, in which case it is whatever I think will cause the most drama. Whatever I think is narratively fun. No internal conflict at all. Just, would this be cool?
Yeah, that's consistent. That's consistent.
I mean, it works. Anyway,
yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for listening to my incredibly dry explanation of theoretical mathematical thought experiments. I don't know. I just thought it could be an interesting like way to kind of map things out in your head or when you're doing tabletop games.
Yeah, that's lots of fun. And it's a great way as a GM and as a player to kind of conceptualize options, because suddenly you get this idea of, oh, okay, there is this perceived risk-reward situation.
Yeah, yeah. There's usually only so many things that a party can realistically do. Because, like, technically you can do anything. Just like, technically, on the Monty Hall show, you could actually pull out a knife and kill Monty and open all three doors. Like, you're allowed to do that. And Dungeons & Dragons allows for that. But if you present your players with those doors, then unless you start using like some other psychological trickery or there's like other context involved, they're gonna do what the model says they're gonna do.
Present two options. They're gonna choose one of them.
Yeah. Yeah, people aren't going to take options that you don't present to them unless you give them a really good reason to do that, because they don't understand what the risks are. They don't understand what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So
on that, I might take us to a little bit of a slice of life then, a little bit further removed from the statistics and the game theory of actions.
Thank God.
Yeah, I know, right? I'm starting to get a bit of a headache.
Talk about that for 2 hours?
I know, right? So I'm going to take us back to Southeast Asia, somewhere between the 5th and 6th century BC. Now, this is the time of Buddha, the real person Buddha. Now, Buddha had a lot of disciples, obviously, huge following, and was a religious leader, as we're aware, and often gave sermons as to various sort of different things. Now, the Buddha once gave a sermon to a group of monks outlining all the games that he refused to play and that his disciples should also abstain from playing.
It's like the AFOB list.
imagine.
God, I hate that.
Imagine Grace waking up.
But
imagine waking up and you like go over to Buddha's house to check the list on his front door to see if you've been put on the AFOB list.
Imagine going to the Buddha's house to check what's on the games list and you find your name.
Do you want to play a round? I'll make you a game.
POV, you find your name on the Buddha's banned games list. This is my new TikTok account.
Please.
So, essentially, there's a bit of debate as to what exactly the Buddha meant by this. But the generally accepted thought is that this was a sermon devoted to a group of monks. And historically, throughout Buddhism, monks were held to a higher standard as far as all the observances than your everyday folk. Now, it also means that they would have been living in a temple subsisting on the alms that people paid. So they were essentially living in a temple being paid for to attain enlightenment.
That's a pretty sweet thing.
Yeah. And so the thought of what this means is because they were living on donations, they couldn't afford to be spending time on games. They had to be taking time to attain enlightenment.
Like people had to get their money's worth.
Yeah, exactly. So essentially it's thought that Buddha was saying, hey, you can't be wasting time. Here's a bunch of ways that I've seen you guys wasting time. Now,
so it really
there is actually
like an ancient call outpost.
It's an ancient call-out post. Yes, absolutely. So essentially, this was delivered to a group of bhikkhus. I don't know, again, how to pronounce that. Sanskrit is difficult to get pronunciations for in English because, it's a different script. So everything I'm reading is an anglicization.
That'll do it.
Yeah, makes it very difficult. But essentially, it was addressing a group of monks to say, hey, you guys are being paid for. Stop this shit. Now, there is actually a little bit of fun wordplay in there, from what I can gather. Unfortunately, it is in Sanskrit, so it's very difficult to decode. But there is a little bit I wanted to share before I got into what games he actually mentioned. And that is Pariapatha, which is the name for hopscotch, or the variant of hopscotch. It happened around a circle. It's also...
God, that's so good. I love that the monks were just dicking around playing hopscotch so much that Buddha had to tell them not to.
And essentially there's...
That's so funny.
That Pariapatha actually also means the roundabout way or a circular path. And so this is thought by some people to be like a subtle dig at like, you need to be following the path of enlightenment, not the path of hopscotch. Fuckers. Now, the other one is Gatika, which is a stick game that I'll go into, but it's also the name for the period of 24 minutes, which is thought to be the ideal time for training to meditate. And it's also the name of an alms bowl for collecting tribute for, let's say, collecting alms to keep the monks subsistent. So it is thought, again, to be a dig at, hey, you are on borrowed time here, stop it.
Was it because they were spending 24 minutes playing this game?
Look, who knows? But yeah, it's again thought to be, he used specific terms for these games that may not have been the widely used terms, so that it had this double meaning. Yeah. But that's sort of more about what Buddha said about the games themselves. So this is 5th and 6th century BC. So this is in Asia. So this is a long time ago. Although, bearing in mind, the earliest recorded dice were found as early as dating back to about 3000 BC. So this is a long time after dice have been invented. But there's a couple of different games that they found. So there were board and tabletop games, essentially. There's one called Ashtapada, which is similar in play style to backgammon, but played on an 8x8 board, like a chessboard. And the idea is you have a bunch of cowrie shells that you can flip, and if they show a star, then that's one, and if they show nothing, that's a zero. And so you flip four cowrie shells, and if you get however many stars you had facing up, that was worth moving your tokens by one. If you had them all facing down, then that was worth eight. And essentially, like backgammon, you had to put your tokens onto the board, you had to race them around the outside, and then you had to race them back and get them off the board. And again, like backgammon, if your opponent landed on a square that you were on, then that token was out.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's very similar to backgammon. It's just played on an 8x8 board.
Okay.
Now, the next one is Dasapada, which is essentially a variation of the same game played on a 10x10 board. Not all that different. But there is actually some speculation. Apparently, both of these games had variations played with dice rather than cowrie shells. So it is worth noting that this is also included in dice games, which are tend to be linked to gambling. So yeah, then there's Akasa, which is the other names translate to Ashtapada, played in the sky. And the idea is that they would just play it like blind chess. It's just imagining the moves that they're making.
That's like the worst version of chess.
I mean, some people get a kick out of it. A kid in my grade in year 6 made a point of playing blind chess, and he was too fucking good at it.
Yeah, because it's impossible to play blind chess. That's fucking stupid.
All you have to do is have a memory of what's on the board. It's just fucked that they can remember that.
Yeah, it's like, but that's what I'm saying. Like, nobody can play blind chess except for the person who dedicates themselves to playing blind chess. So I don't think it's a very fair competition.
Yeah, he also played jazz saxophone.
Well, that explains it. I was going to say, if I knew somebody who dedicated themselves to playing blind chess, that's not someone I want to play blind chess with. Like, that doesn't...
Exactly.
Like, that's like that kid that's really good at a video game coming up to you and being like, oh, do you want to verse me? Like, do you want to play against me? And I'm like, no, because you're going to win, obviously.
And it comes out to that there has to be uncertainty in the outcome for it to be a game. It's not a game if you're definitely going to win.
Yeah. Yeah, there has to be some chance of... Or at the very least, of different good options.
Yeah, I'm not going to go playing Fortnite against Ninja. It's just, it's not going to happen.
But, think of it. Actually, you know what? I probably would play Fortnite against Ninja. Because
actually, because yeah, you could come second. Like, you could come second.
Well, there's so many other factors in Fortnite that there's always a chance that Ninja's going to be killed.
True. I'm not going to play Smash against one of the champions.
Yeah, that's probably that one, you got me there.
So, I often babysit
I'd kick Ninja's ass.
Yeah, you could. I often babysit my cousins, and they've recently gotten old enough that they're allowed to play their dad's old PlayStation 2, and they were playing this like car racing game, and it was so funny because their like eldest sister, every time it gets to the last lap and she's not in first place, she restarts the game. She's like, why? She's like, why would I want to play if I'm not going to win? She is also always racing against her little brother, and she won't let him win out of pity or kindness. It's straight up, if I'm not going to win, what's the point of playing? I'm going to restart this game.
That's crazy.
Last time I babysat them, I had to sit there with the PlayStation like console in my lap so she couldn't reach over with her chubby little fingers and like turn it off.
I mean, I guess it makes sense. Again, from like a game theory perspective, it's objectively the best.
It's the best option.
That's fucked up.
You're old girls, am I right?
Yeah. There's the blind chess version. Then the next one is actually one that we still tend to play now. It's a game called Sun Ticker, which is games where you add or remove from a pile. And the closest analog we have to this is pickup sticks. Essentially, you have to place down sticks, especially made like toothpicks, in a pile and then pick them back up without disturbing the pile.
I've played that game.
Yeah, exactly. We still play this.
I got a bundle for like Christmas from an aunt or something, and they were just like long, skinny, rainbow colored sticks, and she was like, yeah, it's a game. I was like, I've never heard of this, but all right.
I mean, it's also just Jenga.
Yeah, I mean, Jenga would fit into this category the way it's written, because it's games where you add or remove from a pile. So Jenga would be in that vein.
And I think that's the interesting thing about these, and that's probably why I think that they're useful for our purposes mostly, is like all of these games are really just like, they're all just categories, and you can map kind of anything onto this. Like, you could just as easily map political relations onto this as you could Jenga. You
know? Exactly.
It's crazy.
And then the last sort of game of the tabletop game that he talks about is Kalika, which just refers to dice games in general. So this is thought to just mean essentially gambling. It's probably something akin to craps. Obviously not going to be analogous, but that's close enough to the vibe we're going for. There's just no record. These things are most of the time were spoken record. And so there's not really much, at least in English language texts, that describes the games.
Yeah, I mean, especially if the Buddha is outlawing them. Like, I imagine it becomes a lot harder to spread your word-of-mouth rules for your gambling game if the Buddha's putting signs on everyone's door saying, stop gambling arms or I'll kick you out.
Yeah. I mean, like, the people around the place were believably still playing it because a lot of these games have continued. But, yeah, the people in the monastery, not so much. So then there's a bunch of physical games that he talks about. Things like marking diagrams on the floor to walk in certain places. So this is a game like Vinaya Pitaka, which means having drawn a circle with various lines on the ground. There they play avoiding the line to be avoided. So basically they draw on the ground and they avoid the lines. And it's potentially a... Part of this is called parihapata, which is a form of hopscotch. It's something similar to hopscotch, just played in a circle.
Have you ever played, it's like a version of hopscotch that's played in a spiral? It's like French. They literally just call it escargot.
Escargot? Yeah. I think I have played it or something similar. And it sounds like this is something similar to it as well. And again, this is that same double entendre that was supposed to be like, you should be on the path to enlightenment, not the path to hopscotch.
I really love the idea of these monks just like hanging out playing hopscotch.
Right? Here is a really interesting one. So this is Gattaca, which is the modern name for this one is called Tipcat or Gillydunder, and it is described as hitting a short stick with a long stick.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's my favorite game.
Well, actually, if you quickly just check out, look up online, check out on YouTube or something, TipCat. So T-I-P-C-A-T. It looks really fun because essentially what you've got is the short stick that they're talking about is sort of like a bullet shape almost. It's like a thick in the middle and thin on the sides. And what you've got to do is place it on the ground. You hit the short stick to make it bounce up in the air. And then you've got to hit it in the air as far as you can. Imagine playing baseball if you have to serve the ball to yourself.
Yeah, yeah. Except the ball is a stick.
Except the ball is a stick and you've got to serve it from the ground with a stick.
Yeah, you have to hit it really hard so it bounces in the air.
Yeah, but the footage of it looks so fun. And there is video footage of it being played authentically, so clearly it is a game that is still being played, even to this day.
I'm looking just like Google Images. There's heaps of it.
Yeah.
It is like equal representation. There is equal representation of like modern versions versus like ancient drawings.
Yeah, exactly. In
fact, actually, you scroll a little bit further and it's just modern versions.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I love that this is something that is clearly still in rotation that is specifically from South Asia. Like it hasn't really reached the Western world or hasn't lived in the Western world. I love discovering this sort of stuff. Yeah, so then there's really cool. In there, there's also Aka, which means ball games, and then Mokachika, I think that's how you pronounce it, turning somersaults. So essentially, roly poly. Then
I just can't imagine monks doing that.
No.
Just rolling around on the floor.
You can't really, but apparently.
It's a bunch of like Tibetan Buddhist monks just rolling around the monastery.
It gets easier to kind of contextualize if you think about it through the lens of monks being devoted from the age of childhood. So if you think about it in the terms of, to use a pop culture reference, Aang from Avatar, suddenly it makes much more sense to imagine monks playing games like this.
That's true. And I guess, unlike a lot of kids, they're then stuck for their whole lives with their childhood friend group, so you're probably just going to play dumb games forever.
Exactly. Then there's imagination games. So there's a ton of imagination games that they used to play. Salakahata is an interesting one. Have you ever played the doodle game? It's where somebody draws just a quick, like, a weird squiggle, and you have to draw something using that squiggle.
Oh, yeah. I used to play that in picture chat with people.
Yeah, perfect. So it is
essentially
that. So what they would do, they would dip their hands with their fingers outstretched in lac or red dye or flower water, and then they would strike the wet hand on the ground or a wall and yell out, "What shall it be?" And other people would have to then make an image out of it, whether it be, and they would show the form required. Yeah.
I like that.
And I think the way it's described, it sounds like they hit the wall, say, "What shall it be?" And everyone calls out what they think it should be. And then you've got to make that image out of that thing.
That's fun.
Yeah.
I like that. It's a good game.
Then there's Akarika, which is guessing the letters traced with the finger in the air or on a friend's back.
Oh, good. I'm glad that that's a timeless one.
Hmm. Which is interesting if you think about the fact that this was in Sanskrit. Because if you have a look at Sanskrit symbols, I feel like these would be much more inscrutable than any Roman script, anything with the Roman alphabet.
Well, yeah, because I mean, this is a game that exists in places that use the Roman alphabet, but we don't do it in the air.
You
draw letters in the air to show kids how to write letters on the page. Like, it's that obvious that it's like a demonstration of how to write. Like, you'd only ever do that on someone where they couldn't see.
Yeah, and that's the thing is this, having a look at Sanskrit, maybe it's just that the symbols are less familiar, but it's all based on similar shapes, so it would be a lot more difficult, I would imagine.
Like how it would be harder to tell between, like if you're doing in the air, like a Q and a P and an A and a C would be like harder than like you could tell if it was a Z.
Exactly. But yeah, so that's another one that has survived and prospered, perhaps been independently invented in a bunch of different places. Then there's two more, Manasika and Vathavaya, which is guessing a friend's thoughts and imitating deformities. That last one kind of comes out of nowhere. But
yeah, Jesus.
Yeah, that was a game that the Buddha put to bed. Yeah. Yes. So that's, yeah, that last one's a little bit unsavory, which is why I didn't leave it till the end. Then there's a little depiction of a couple of different toys that they had. So there are a bunch of games with toys. So blowing through a pat kulal, which is a pipe made of leaves. So it's just basically a little toy pipe made of reeds. Then there's plowing with a toy plow, or translation issues may mean that that's using a toy fish hook. And it's thought that this was more so condemned because of the potential for its connotations with animal cruelty or with consumption of animals.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. Then there's singalika, which is playing with toy windmills made from palm leaves. Padalaka, playing with toy measures made from palm leaves. So little measuring cups, which is something we still see today.
That's true.
There's Rathaka, which is playing with toy carts or toy chariots. And Danuka, which is playing with toy bows, which again, you see in the modern era.
Yeah,
and
all of these are just like regular kids' toys.
Exactly. And so the reason that I brought this is because it's a lovely sort of snapshot in time of different things that realistically have existed since the 5th, since the 6th century BC. So this is 2,700 years at least. 2,500 years at least. And yeah. So as far as a historical context, any of these things are conceivably games that anyone could be playing. And so if you're ever after everyday things that people are doing, any one of these is a good place to start. I mean, they could be playing with the toy windmill. They could be doing the doodle game just with a wet hand. They could be playing board games in the sky. It's really up to you what you want to take from it. But it, as a depiction of the everyday lives of people, this was just such a fun slice of life to take.
Yeah, that's neat.
Yeah.
It's fun that kids have always been playing the same games, and it's fun that adults have always hated it.
Yeah, pretty much. And with that, I think we've given us a lot of really practical ways to start putting stuff into practice. So rather than coming up with a story hook to add an extra 10 minutes to an already long episode, we might just leave us there. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. As you heard at the beginning, if you wanted to get in contact, please, please feel free to email us on deepdivetnc@gmail.com or contact us on @DungeonDeepDive on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We get notifications for it. And as you heard, we're very excited to get any emails.
And yeah, I mean, let us know if you use any of these things, if you incorporate any of the like different games and stuff into your things, if you plan anything based on those like models or whatever, let us know. That'd be cool.
Exactly.
Personally, just for my enjoyment, I'd love to find out what you and your grade got banned at school. That's not for D&D, that's just for me. I'd love to know what like rowdy childhood you had.
Thank you so much, everybody. Please feel free, get in contact. We'd love to hear what games got banned or what you're using. And until next time, I don't have a sign off for this podcast. Bye.
Fucking bye.
See ya.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.